could tell it was like a roller coaster ride because they were a non-for-profit research organization. And so their work with companies had to be balanced against their work with government agencies. They theoretically lost money on the work with government agencies, made money on the part with companies, and they broke even. So when the government contracts varied, they had huge swings in people and laid off people and so forth. And I always found that very disturbing. But it was an interesting place to work because they saw a lot of inventions. And it was when I was there, Chester Carlson walked in off the street with the invention of the Xerox machine. And he was given some space to work. And they developed Xerox at Battelle. Many people became millionaires. I remember in the first days of the Xerox, they had a you had to put the paper to be copied on a plate, and then the inside underneath the plate was the toner, and you had to shake it back and forth. It was a single sheet at a time process, manual process. Shake it back and forth, and when you finished doing that, then you put it in the machine, and you got a copy. Well, at Battelle, that was great fun because they had this series of women who did these copies in the copy room, and so the guys would all go down, bring copies down that they didn't need, to watch this one big redhead who was very voluptuous shake these plates back and forth. But if you can imagine, compared to today, what the first Xerox was like. And it's grown, of course, into one of the world's great businesses. Battelle became very rich. As a result, they sold it to Haloid Corporation, which subsequently became Xerox Corporation, and got a great deal of stock. But I decided that I wanted to leave and get into something more stable. And it turns out that Atlantic Refining was visiting Ohio State, and Joe Kofold, he was the chairman of the department, called me up and he said, "Say, Hal," he said, "I made a terrible mistake and it's very embarrassing. We don't have anybody on Atlantic Refining's schedule," he said, "and their representative is here." He said, "Well, could you come over and interview?" Just so trying to get four or five guys to talk to these people. He said, "It's very embarrassing." He said, "Someday we may need them, but you know, nobody's interested." So I went over to talk with them, and I remembered them well. I remember they cheated me out of $4 and on the train fare 4 or 5 years earlier. And so, lo and behold, they invited me to go to Philadelphia. And I said to them at the time, I said, "Well, I'm not coming unless you make a hotel reservation for me and pay for the plane ticket and send it to me in advance." I figured, I'm not going to let these guys screw me out of some money. So I went, and they offered me a job for, I think it was $500 a month, $450 a month, with a master's degree. And on the way back, I stopped to see U.S. Steel, and they offered me $500 a month. So when I got back to Columbus, I called Atlantic Refining and told them, their offer just wasn't competitive. And they said, "Well, we don't bargain with people. We do a survey. We know we're competitive." And I said, "Fine. I'm not interested in your job." The next day they called me back and they offered me $550. Well, here was this company I didn't really want to work for, but now they were offering me $50 a month more than U.S. Steel. So I said, "Well, I better think about this." And so $600 was a huge amount of money, you know, when you were making $4,800 or $5,000. So I took the job at Arco.
Just wind back, Hal, and take me out of Battelle through Ohio State.
Take you after Battelle and through Ohio?
I mean, were you doing the Ohio State Masters while you were at Battelle?
Yes, I did.
How did that work?
I did the Masters at Ohio State when I was at Battelle. They allowed us to go over and take courses and to work, and I did a thesis there on fluid beds under a professor named Bob Brodke, who is a fluid dynamic expert. He's still around. I spoke to him by phone. He was away when I visited the campus Monday. And Brodsky was my advisor, and what we were trying to do was simulate meltdown of nuclear reactors and so forth, which was kind of an extension of some work that I did at Battelle. And so we did a thesis and took the coursework and graduated. And I have to say this about Ohio State. Ohio State's been very good to me over the years. I'm a recipient of the Benjamin G. LeMay Medal for Distinguished Engineering Graduates. And they also have given me a Doctor of Humane Letters, which I very much appreciated, which kind of recognized my contributions to many civic and charitable things, in addition to my industrial contributions. And over time, every once in a while, they ask me to come back and lecture on something, and I did just recently, and I'm going to probably go back this fall and lecture at chemical engineering. Mm-hmm. So I had a very favorable experience there. I had a very favorable experience socially out there. Battelle was a place with a lot of young people, and we had a young people's club, and we got together and had a lot of events, and it was great. Columbus is a great town and a great university town, and a very fine place to live. You know, your cultural life centered around the university. I was surprised to hear when I was there just recently that they have a new theater center and so forth, where they had three different things going on at the same night. Back when I was there, there wasn't that much theater and so forth, but it's a really much more cosmopolitan city today than it was then. But it was a great city to live in, virtually no crime. University was the center of the town. It's a great university, and just a good place to be.
How long were you at Battelle?
3.5 years.
Yeah. 55 to 59. Yeah. Can you talk a little in the territory, as it were, of role models? We hear a lot today about role models, but had you figured out by this time what you wanted to do when you grew up? Or
no, I think Herman Mack was kind of a role model, because he was a very inventive and creative man. And I was still in research. And when I left Battelle, I went to work in research. And so Mack was a person who had a great many ideas and seemed to be able to create those into something practical. And so from that standpoint, he was one. Really, the basic role models came somewhat later at Battelle, from the standpoint of people that I admired who were very entrepreneurial and a very different kind of company environment. But at my early years were more framed by he was the person I worked for, the inventiveness of this guy. And his creativity, and the way he encouraged creativity, which was very important in the research atmosphere. So I think that's really what Battelle gave to me. When I went to ARCO, it was a different set of role models and different set of people.
You were, as you'd said, you were looking to move on from Battelle, and but still in research.
Still in research, and I took a job in research at Atlantic Refining.
That was in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, yes, yes. Was that? I mean, that too is a long way from Brooklyn, or not?
Yeah, it was, but closer. And, you know, it was a few hours and away, and that was one of the things that influenced me in taking the job, was the fact that it was much closer to New York and to my family. And we made the trek from Philadelphia at least once a month to New York to stay with my mother and so forth. Even though she didn't have room, she insisted that we stay there. And it took us years to convince her that we were the ones who should be sleeping on the pull-out sofa, not her. But we made that trek, so it was closer. And then I was able to get back more. But Atlantic Refining was, in many ways, a company that was not a very good choice because there was a lot of prejudice there, and they were penny wise and dollar foolish, pound foolish. Give you an example. Now remember, they had cheated me out of $4. So I drive to Philadelphia with all my worldly possessions loaded in a convertible. Now, you know, when I got to Philadelphia, I very quickly realized you can't leave a convertible on the street with all those goods in them and so forth. So I then turned to New York, drove to New York, Columbus to Philadelphia to New York, where I dropped off all my worldly possessions, just keeping some clothes, came back. And so I charged them for the mileage. And they were paying 8 cents a mile or 6 cents a mile. It was not much. I mean, it was 500 miles, you know. So $30 or so. Whereupon the chief financial officer of the research department, a man named Willard Houghton, comes down, throws my expense account on the desk and says, 412 miles from Columbus to Philadelphia, that's all we'll pay for. So I said, here we go again. I tried to explain, he wasn't having any of it, turned around and left, and notified my boss, it was a man named George Masalagides, notified my boss that unless I adjusted my expense account, he should fire me. So Masalagides called me in and said, look, I'm not discussing this with you, I'm just telling you this is what the expense account was and it should be and so forth, and that was it. And you either accept it or you're out. And so here I was, again, they cheated me out of my money because I could have shipped the goods and who could have cost the money, but of course I ran back and forth to New York to get rid of them. And so it was kind of interesting, but I was there, so I took it. I changed the expense account, took the job, and it was.
When did you start?
In July of '59.
And what were you to do?
I was a chemical engineer in the development department, and to make a long story short, they issued you a single mechanical pencil, and to get it. If it broke, you had to turn it in the old one to get a new one. And when they issued a service pin, if you'd been there 5 years, 5 years later they gave you another one, had a little diamond on it, you didn't get the new one until you turned in the old one. And those were the kinds of things that they did. See. And I worked there, and it was very interesting. There was a man named Lou Reen who worked there, and he was... later to become a president of the company. It was interesting, the clerk who worked for me was a fellow by the name of Jack Johnson, who worked for our group, he didn't work for me, was a man by the name of Jack Johnson, who later became my number two, and went to school for 9 years at night at Drexel, had six children, went into the Marines, came out, and did a... marvelous job and moved up through the ranks. So, some talented people. I worked for a man named George Bressler, and he was a man who was disappointed in his not being advanced and so forth. And he gave me a piece of advice. He said, I'll always remember this. He said, once they start crapping on you, he said, if you don't move, you just get covered with it. So he said, if that ever happens to you, don't do what I do. Then you just, he said, there's always a time to move on. Well, I never really moved on because I stayed 32 years. But there was a man named Hank Rain, who was the head of the development department, who was a very bright guy and very creative. And then there was a another fellow by the name of Ed Katz. Katz and I became very good friends. It's interesting that those two were Jewish, the only Jews that there were in the company, I think, at that time. I had an interesting experience. I became a supervisor. When my boss went back to Penn to work for a PhD, took a leave to go get his PhD at Penn. His name was Dick Worrell, and I replaced him. And very soon thereafter, I hired Dave Verisco, Frank Nicastro, and a fellow by the name of Goldberg, whereupon I was visited by the head of personnel, who said to me, "You just recently became the supervisor, and you hired Castro, Verisco, and Goldberg, and now you got Rosenberg coming in for an interview." Now, just imagine the indignity of this. He said to me, "When Smith from Yale comes down and has to talk to Castro, Verisco, Goldberg, Rosenberg, and Sorgeny, how do you think we'll ever hire him? He won't have anyone decent to talk to." "The answer," he said, "is you're not making Rosenberg an offer." I said to him, "Now you listen to me," I said. "Every one of those people was first in his class." He said, "I don't care whether they walk on water. We're not interested." "Okay," he said, "if you want to keep your job," he said, "do what you're told." So that was interesting. I said to myself, "Boy, you know, this is really the pits." But I stayed, and then I was in charge of the speakers committee. I remember the same thing happened. Came down and I said, "Who are these people?" And I said, "Well, they're tops in their field. We don't want them. Don't you understand? Somebody from Princeton, MIT, Carnegie Tech. We don't..." There were a couple of them were Jewish. "We don't want them." So they wouldn't let me do that. So it was interesting. There was a deep-seated prejudice there that existed and so forth. And one of the interesting things was when I came back many years later, it was the heir apparent. This particular individual was still there. And I had the great joy of retiring. In the time that when I was away, I remember there was a black dentist that applied to the Swarthmore Swim Club. And he was very vocal in all the papers about opposing the admittance of a black to the Swarthmore Swim Club. And I remember saying, "You know, this is a new world, and you're still living in the old one, and we can't really tolerate that. I think it's time for you to leave." So it was kind of interesting. I always remember we had a discussion on diversity at the Core States Board many years later. And the subject came up, and one of the directors insisted that in the diversity policy, the word that we don't discriminate because of sexual persuasion. And it had in there against blacks, Hispanics, Orientals, and so forth, and people of different sexual persuasions. And so I raised my hand and I said, if we want to put that in, we've got to, you know, add Jews and Italians and so on and so forth. And one of the members of the board said, "There's no discrimination against Italians. I mean, after all, you became president of your company." And I said, "Yes." And I said, and I clawed my way to the top. "You think it was easy? And I didn't face a lot of discrimination?" And I said, "Just as an example, how many Jews are there in this room?" You know, I said, "The banks are notorious for not having promoted, hired Jews and so forth. And you're still way behind the times. Hopefully that problem has passed us in other fields." But it was interesting that, you know, I had friends who graduated from, his fathers graduated from City College. They were working as postmen, other things, because they couldn't get jobs when they got out of City College. So even in the 50s, there still was this deep-seated undercurrent that existed. And over the years, I had seen many, many instances of overt prejudice where, you know, there wasn't a lot that you could do about it. But when I was able to do something about it, our company was a very open company, and people were promoted on the basis of their ability, not what they were or what their color. I always remember the chief financial officer. One time we were talking about promoting a Korean to be chief financial officer at a Korean company. And he said to me, he said at the meeting, management meeting, he said, "You can't trust those people. We shouldn't promote them." And I remember saying to him at the time, "You listen to me." I said, "I don't care whether an employee of this company is black, white, yellow, or green. They're all the same. And you cannot sit here and tell me that. And I won't, first of all, listen to it. And secondly, you shouldn't be saying it. Give them a job." And so because of my early experience, I'm saying, that really shaped a great deal of my own people about the worth of each individual in the company, the lack of discrimination and picking people on the basis of merit and not background. And I can tell you, I can go on for hours about some of the things that have experienced that have happened. I'll always remember there was one fellow who was out of work, and he came to see me about a job. And he said, "Remember, I went to PS 160, Junior High School 220, and City College, Fort Hamilton High School." And he said to me, first words he said, "I went to the Haverford School." And I said, "Oh, well, I'm certainly glad to hear that." He said, "And then Princeton. And I'm very, very active at Princeton alumni." And I said, "Well, you know, I went to PS 160 and City College." And in those days, people were so insensitive to other people's feelings and whatnot that they spotted these things out and true measure their feelings. And so over the years, I've seen a lot of discrimination. But you asked before about role models. Bob Anderson, Thornton Bradshaw, and the senior management of our company, a man by the name of Bill Kieschner, they were people that were great leaders. They were visionaries. Our company was, once they took over, was in the vanguard of corporations and the way they treated their people.
Well, this is much later in your
career. Well, it turns out I was at Atlantic Refining 4, 5, 6 years, and I was going to leave, and I had an offer from Mobil, because Atlantic Refining was not a very progressive company. And one day they brought this guy through in a 10-gallon hat, a little guy, and they were showing him around, and he stood up in the courtyard there of the building, which was like a giant bathroom. It was designed with green tile and so forth. And his company, we had just bought his company, but somehow he had taken control of ARCO. This went back, I'd only been there 5 years, in the early 60s. And he stood up on the little box that he was stood up on, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "next time we build a research center," he says, "we're going to design it rather than engineer it." He said, "This is a very well-engineered building," he said. "But," he said, "we need an environment to stimulate creativity and so on and so forth." He spoke about the kinds of company that he wanted to build. And I remember going home that night and saying to Ann, "You know, I saw this little guy come in, and he's just gotten a lot of shares in the company stock, and he's going to be chairman of the stock. I think he's going to do something with this company. I think I'll stay."
Who was that?
Bob Anderson. Mm-hmm. And so very early on, I could see that he was different and that he would do something with the company, and he did. And he made a great company, and I'm saying, talk about diversity. I mean, he had people who were friends from Truman Capote and Tommy Brookshire to presidents and kings. And when you were with him, you might meet just about anybody. And because he had such a great, and a great interest in art and supporting the arts, and so on, encouraging his people to do those things. So you know, he really was a Renaissance man. And I'd say he and Thornton Bradshaw were role models for me.
Let's just stay in the little earlier period, yeah. a little longer, if
yes.
I may, and. When you went to Atlantic, that first half dozen years, how did you self-define? What were you doing? Were you doing engineering?
I was doing process development. I give you a difference in this little vignette that I'll describe. It shows you the tremendous difference that occurred. We had, at that time, there was a lot of pressure on replacing bio-hard detergents with soft detergents. We invented a process for making linear alkyl benzenes, of which I was one of the inventors. I'll talk a little bit more about, in my research years, Arnold, I have responsibility for four major processes that I invented. But in a very different process, we used radiation to excite the molecules and to cause them to react. Other people didn't do it that way, but we produced linear alkyl benzenes, and Atlantic had invented these detergents way back in the 30s. So we were a leader, and now we were being pressed to produce soft detergents. So we had this process, and we subsequently went to the board for approval. It was $4 million. And the board was chaired by Henderson Sapley. God love him. He was a nice man. And I was friendly with him for years. The board decided that $4 million was too much to risk on chemicals. And so Bob Bent, who was the head of chemicals then, he and I headed the company for most of its life with just one person in between, Dick Bressler. Bob Bent came back and said, if you can do it for $2 million, that's the limit of the approval the board will give. So we went back to the drawing boards and we built this plant for $2 million. And it was successful. And we subsequently built two more. So there were three plants for those, one of them a joint venture in Germany. Several years went by, and we had another invention, a product to produce benzene from toluene, hydrodealkylation. We invented that process, and we did commercialize it, and I think there were 15 or 20 licensees for that process. And then from there, we started to work on propylene oxide. And the work was split between two groups. The research group was working on what I'll characterize as the easy part, the epoxidation of propylene with hydroperoxides, but nobody knew how to make the hydroperoxides. Hydroperoxides are very unstable and they decompose. And so we were working on the first part and largely unsuccessfully. The head of research came along and he said that the head of the research department said to the vice president of research, those engineers, they don't know what they're doing. Turn that work over to us and we'll be successful. And they've been working on this for a couple of years and they're getting nowhere. And we've got the back end of the process worked out. Well, I was in charge of the work on the front end of the process. Well, lo and behold, and this goes to a story that one of the men who was head of development was this fellow George Masalagidis. And Masalagidis was one of the great analysts of data, and he produced correlations, all that were done by hand, which are now done by computer. And one of the things that he taught me is you always look for the points that don't fit. They tell you the story. The points that fit are just confirming what you already know. Hello.